All right, folks, welcome to Crew Call Volume 1, Number 3 with Mike Rose. And my partner in crime this month is Kaylee Zhang. Hey, Kaylee.
Hi, Mike. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for joining me. I really appreciate your being part of the crew on Crew Call.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you for the invite. I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, you know, the goal here is, or really the theme here is, interesting people doing interesting things, you know, and I thought of you immediately.
Oh, thanks. I appreciate that.
I mean, you're fairly well known, I think, in the proto meat circuit, at least probably on the East Coast. I don't know how many other proto meets you've been to, but why don't you just give us a quickie once over on, you know, what your interest is in trains and, you know, we'll kind of go from there, I guess.
Sure, absolutely. So I grew up in a town called Phillipsburg. And now for anyone who does any sort of East Coast modeling, a lot of people will recognize the town of Phillipsburg, New Jersey. And that was the town on the Jersey side along the Delaware River that separates Easton, Allentown, and more importantly, Bethlehem.
Even more importantly, you're on the Lehigh Line.
Exactly. Exactly. So I grew up alongside the Lehigh Line, and that's kind of what got me into trains was having my bedroom window face the tracks. And wow. I just remember standing at this going way back when we still had the sides of my bed, and I just remember staring out at the slats and looking at the trains rolling by and just being mesmerized by the different shapes, the colors, and then the sound, really. I think
how old were you at that time?
I might have been 2.
Oh my gosh, yeah, okay.
So it's one of those things where it's so distinctive that it's etched in my mind permanently.
Oh yeah, well, it's a very formative time, right? And how long did you live there? Like, did you live there for until you were, you know, a teenager or longer?
Well, my parents did emigrate from China, so they were restaurant workers. So where we had the apartment was close to the restaurant. And I was in that apartment till maybe I was around 6 years old, maybe 5. And then my parents bought their first house in another town. But it was all still pretty much along the Lehigh Line. So all throughout childhood, I always grew up within the earshot of a horn.
That's pretty cool. And when you were in that earlier apartment, how far from the tracks were you?
Maybe 2 or 3 blocks. It wasn't that far, but it wasn't like right up against the tracks either.
Yeah, yeah. And was it Conrail in those days?
It was Conrail, yep.
Yeah, that makes sense. So do you consider yourself a Conrail modeler?
For sure, absolutely.
Well, that would explain the couple of Conrail locos you bought from me back in the day.
Back in the day, yeah, that's true.
Now, we ran into each other, I think, first at the New England Proto Meet, probably, right?
I want to say so, yeah. I think it was maybe 2014.
Okay, if you can remember that, you're a better person than I am, because all that's like a blur to me. Could have just as easily been Valley Forge or
right.
You know, any of these other meets.
Right.
I did have a period there where, and this, I'm going back a ways, but my friend Dave calls it the Micros Victory Tour. And after my divorce, and I was just getting back out into the world again. And I think I went to like everything, you know, I went to WPM. I went to Naperville. I went to Cocoa Beach. I went to Savannah. Mm-hmm. I mean, you name it. The only one I haven't been to that I wish I had, but it'll probably never happen, is the St. Louis meet, because it has a reputation of being a great meet. But, you know, the time of year that it is, and plus the fact that I'm sort of stuck in the basement a lot more these days.
well, layout's not going to build itself, right?
Exactly. See, you understand. I'm going to go to the Valley Forge meet, though, this year. That's
oh, fantastic.
It's every other year, and it's right in the heart of my modeling area, sort of, and I know a lot of people down there, really nice people, and it's just always a good gig. So I missed it once, and that resulted in a 4-year gap, you know what I mean? And I just thought, nah,
it's kind of amusing, right? Because you think about it, every 2 years, every other year, well, you miss one, then it's the next time is going to be another 2 years, so that's a 4-year gap right there.
Well, and generally my clinic is on whatever it is that I'm doing at that time. And at one time it was local modeling and freight car modeling, but boy, the last few years it's been all layout. So you can imagine at the rate that I work, a 2-year update, I have a hard time fitting it into the clinic slot. You know, it's 'cause usually I would start where the last one left off, but 2 years worth of updates, you have to do some serious condensing.
Absolutely.
Now, do you have a layout?
It's a work in progress. Right now, I'm still, so I have a kind of a concept that's built into my mind, but right now I'm still trying to get the basement all prepped up. Okay. I'm fortunate in that the house that I bought has a finished basement, but unfortunately it's has the dreaded popcorn ceiling. So I want to scrape all that off and whilst I'm at it, kind of get the lighting all installed.
It sounds like a good job for somebody else.
It does. it's one of those things where on the one hand, I want to do it because I know I can control the quality and I can kind of control the outcome.
But on the other hand, it's the mess.
Exactly. On the other hand, it's like, there's just not enough time in the world that I could possibly stop everything what I need to do and actually just finish it. But
have you started the process?
I have. So the way my basement is constructed is that there's kind of like a front room and a back room. And the beam that runs kind of through the center of the house forms a nice little partition. So I'm able to kind of tape up and seal off the back half and kind of focus on one half. So the plan is to do the front half first, scrape off the popcorn, patch up any of the ceiling work I need to do, drop in any of the electrical stuff, and then put the lights up and then paint it, get it all situated, and then move everything from the back room to the front room and then rinse, wash, and repeat.
Yeah, no, that's smart. So how bad has it been? I mean, I've heard stories about this, but from what I've read, I guess one of the ways of doing it is to sort of wet it and then just scrape it off, basically?
Yeah, exactly. And it, surprisingly, it works. I was skeptical at first. I'm thinking, like, why would you want to shoot water into sheetrock?
Right.
But it actually works. It miraculously works. What I use instead of some people say use a garden hose. Yeah, that you run the risk there with having too much water. But
where did the water go?
So that's the tricky thing. What they suggest, I talked to the lovely folks at the Home Depot, and what they suggest was using like a regular old garden sprayer, like you pesticide. Those little pump up containers.
Oh, sure. That makes sense.
Right. So you just pump it up and spray that on to the point where you just see water starting to drip off the ceiling.
Okay.
Because what it is, popcorn ceiling is just basically plaster.
Okay.
So it's very, very hydroscopic. So it will suck up water like crazy. So once you get it soaked, nice and soaked, it literally just scrapes right off.
Now, could you use like a wet dry shop vac to take it off and not have so much to sort of pick up, or would that just be a fool's errand?
It's kind of one of those things. They do make attachments where like scrapers, you could put a trash bag or you could put a shop vac.
Right.
I think what I've learned is that doing that when you scrape off, it's not coming off in little flakes. It's coming up in giant chunks, so it'll overwhelm it. So at that point, I'm fortunate I have tile on the for flooring. So I just let it drop to the floor and then swept it up afterwards.
Oh, interesting. And do you have to skim coat the ceiling when you're all done, you think?
There's small areas where I nicked it, but for the most part, not too bad. Where I actually have to do some more patching is where I cut into the sheetrocks to run the wire, the electrical for the lighting.
Yep.
In that area, I do need to patch up, and that's been my biggest holdup is the mudding, which I've never done in my life. So,
yeah, I've done way too much of it. It's you know, it's one of those things that there's no substitute for experience with it. You know, mm-hmm. and I mean, at this point, I'm pretty decent at it. I don't know that I'm
want to come over.
Well, no. It's like helping somebody move, you know.
No, I totally understand.
I like you, not that much. and there's not many people in the world I would do that for. I did my bathroom one time, and I was removing two skylights and several recessed lights, because it was all just leaking cold air into the master bath. So the mm-hmm. goal was to make it warm in my old age. And I ended up having to sort of redo the whole ceiling pretty much myself. And boy, you know, if you think walls are bad, ceilings are worse, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I ended up having to rent one of those ceiling sanders, you know, from our friendly Home Depot. And when I left the room, even though I had a vacuum and all that, when I left the room, I was white, completely mm-hmm. covered with the powder.
Yep.
And of course I had dust, you know, dust mask protection and all of that. But I just thought, hey, there's something that I'm probably never going to do again.
Yeah. I'm rapidly learning that what started off as a simple idea is turned into a little more of a project than I was hoping for.
Well, you know, I know what I understand what you're saying about doing it yourself. You can control the mess and sort of the pace of things and the quality. Because when I had my addition done, you've been here, you saw it. To me, it's a pretty big room. Mm-hmm. But by the contractor standards, it's such a small job that it's hard to get anybody that's really interested in it, you know?
Right.
So I was lucky to get somebody to come in and do it. And as it turns out, even those guys were, I think, two different subcontractors for the small contractor that I got to do it, even though it was a drywall company. And the two guys that came in and did the mudding and the sanding were not ideal. There were some communications issues, uh-huh. and basically they came in and power sanded the whole thing.
Oh, geez.
Without dust collection.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
So when I got down there and I realized that the entire room was coated with the dust and that they had dropped, you know, mud all over the fresh concrete floor and not really bothered to clean it up. And it was so dusty that it actually leaked into the original railroad room, even though I had plastic up. I kind of had several kittens about it, you know, and the contractor came down and, you know, he basically said, how much off do you want on this? Because he, I don't think, thought, we both agreed that those two guys were not the guys to have come back and clean everything up. So mm-hmm. I think I ended up getting $400 off the job, and it's probably, I probably earned about $4 an hour at $400 in cleaning the whole thing up. But like you say, it got cleaned up totally and right and in a much better mm-hmm. fashion than they would have done it. And I right. just kind of chalked it off to the unavoidable lessons learned kind of a thing, you know?
Right.
You said you were installing lighting, but that probably implies that you have sort of I don't want to say so much of a track plan as in a bench work plan. Like you have mm-hmm. some idea where your aisles are going to be and all of that.
Yep. Yep. So for the most part, the layout design is intended to be kind of along the wall. I think that's the amount of space that I have. It makes the most sense.
Yep.
If I try to do a peninsula, it just would have the aisles would have been less than ideal.
Sure. And that's important, because mm-hmm. if you're not keeping people movement in mind during an op session and, you know, if it's just your layout and you don't, you know, you're the lonely guy and you don't have any friends and it's just you running it, your issues are different than if you've been to op sessions where they haven't paid sufficient attention to that and people are sort of, you know, trying to climb over one another to get down aisles. Mm-hmm. I learned a lot about what to do and what not to do by going to as many op sessions as I could. And, you know, in fairness, most people do it right. But I think the thing that I learned is it's okay to have a pinch point. Just make sure it's a point and not anything of any distance. You know, that was sort right. of the first thing that I learned. So your layout will go basically around the entire perimeter of the basement?
Most of it. I would say maybe 75% of it.
So you'll have either a duck under or a bridge of some kind to get into it, I assume.
No, actually, it's the way it's shaped is like a giant question mark.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And that's just kind of the topography of the basement. The back room is more of a bigger rectangle and the front room is more like a square.
Okay. I went to one layout that was like that. In fact, years ago, Scott and I visited Bill Darnaby's layout out when we went to Naperville. And the best way I can describe his layout was sort of like a square spiral.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
and you would literally just, I mean, I think it would probably three concentric, trips around to get to sort of the middle. And I don't think that's, you know, fully accurate, but mm-hmm. it was the only layout that I've ever been to, that's like that. Mm-hmm. My addition layout has some of those qualities because, you know, you walk in that main door that you're familiar with and you walk all the way down by Pittston Yard, which I don't know if you've seen the pictures on the podcast group on Facebook, but there are partitions up now. So Pittston Yard has a backdrop and Taylor Peninsula has the divider down the middle of it. And, you know, you walk all the way down Pittston and go through the bridge and then take a right and go all the way back down Taylor and then loop around and you go all the way down the other side. So if you're all the way down that end and you've got to get to that door, you've got some, you know, you've got some traveling to do basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it extends, you're more immersed into the scenes.
Right. But you know, ever since I put the backdrops up for the first time, now I can see how it's really going to be and how you're going to interact with it, because the goal is not to look at, you know, the whole thing in one glance like it's in a gymnasium. You know, mm-hmm. the idea is you want to follow your train and be paying attention to your local scene, which has a backdrop to it that shouldn't be some other scene, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. So I tell you, when I put the backdrops up, it just changed everything so totally that I just kind of stood there and looked at it for a while because I thought, wow, is that really how I want it to look? it was just so different. And right. It really took me like a couple of days to, sort of get used to that. But I warmed up to it pretty quickly because that's, mm-hmm. you know, that's kind of how it's supposed to be, right?
Right.
So what's the concept of your layout? Is it a Conrail layout?
Originally, it did start out as a Conrail layout. And so what I started to realize or at least struggle with was as I was trying to lay it out, I was trying to figure out where I would want to, what line did I want to model, what aspect of Conrail.
Right.
The dream layout.
A lot to choose from.
I know, right? The dream layout was actually to do the Lehigh line, but pick up from Allentown, basically okay. along where I grew up, from Allentown all the way out to Oak Island.
Oh, sure.
And
so you'd have to have Musconetcong Tunnel and all of that, right?
Exactly. Yep. Mm-hmm. Bound Brook and a lot of these well-named famous places, popular rail fan spots.
Basically, your layout would start where mine left off.
Pretty much, yeah. But what I realized quickly, especially in the later years of Conrail, it became more and more of a bridge traffic. So for me to do it properly, it would have needed to be a double-deck layout at a minimum.
Sure.
But even then, I don't think I could have been able to get in all the towns that I wanted to get in, especially if I was doing Allentown. I know it's going to be the yard itself. I could probably do a simple staging.
Yep.
But CP Bethlehem coming across the river and meeting up with the Reading line and then Lehigh line starts, that's pretty iconic. I wanted to do that. Definitely needed to do Phillipsburg. Definitely needed to do Bound
Brook. You wanted to have a turnout on a bridge, didn't you?
Yeah, exactly.
It sounds like something Jim Lincoln should build.
I know, right? Hey, Jim, here's a challenge for you.
Really?
So at the end of the day, when I started stacking it all up, it's like, I'm not going to be able to have enough space to do it faithfully. So then I thought about doing, okay, maybe I could do one of the secondaries that kind of branch off the Lehigh line. So
like the cement belt or something like that?
Right. So either I could have done the cement secondary or the Washington secondary, which then that kind of sneaked along through my hometown after my parents moved from the apartment and bought the house.
I'm not familiar with the Washington Secondary. Where does that terminate?
So it starts right after you cross the Delaware.
Okay.
At CP Phillipsburg. The main line kind of splits off to all the left, and that starts the Washington Secondary, and it snakes all the way up to Washington, New Jersey, hence Washington Secondary.
I haven't the faintest idea where that is.
So Washington, New Jersey is kind of like the northernmost point in Warren County in New Jersey. So it's, oh gosh, I want to say maybe half an hour, 45 minutes from Port Jervis.
Oh, okay. So it's kind of like an inland route.
It's pretty much, yeah. And it snakes all the way up to, there's some industries up there, and there's a yard, little yard there. The biggest customer is BASF, a chemical processing company that's up there.
They don't make things, they just make things better.
Exactly.
Does the line connect up to Conrail heading up towards Port Jervis also?
I don't think so, because typically that train, it operates as a turn. So it starts in Allentown Yard, goes out, works the industries along the way, and then comes back. It's typically they leave the yard around, I want to say like 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock-ish. And then they come back by 4 or 5 p.m.
It sounds like a nice gig, actually. So you're going to do a series of towns, small towns, and industries, basically.
But right, that was my thought. But then, as when I started looking to the schedule, they only had that one train, and that was it.
Mm.
And that even then, it ran, I think, Monday through Thursday.
Right. So even though, like, if you think about my original layout room that has the, you know, Lacyville and Skinner's Eddy and all of that, which are small towns with small consignees sort of strung along it, there were still some through trains that went through there as well. It wasn't a dead end line. So you rejected that one, I guess.
Right. So I pretty much tossed out that and out of the window. And that was really it in terms of secondaries along the Lehigh line. There was a couple of other lines that went into consideration, but ultimately I kind of abandoned the idea of doing a Conrail layout.
Were you at that time sort of poring over the ZTS?
I was.
Yeah.
Looking all over the place. And
that's
just,
not small.
No, it was not. I think part of the frustration was because it was so big and my eyes were so strained from looking at the computer screen, trying to studying what possible alternatives that I could do.
Yep.
But then I moved up here to Connecticut, and originally for schooling, but
then for work.
But I kind of grew in love with some of the little short lines that exist here. Yeah, we have the Springfield line that kind of runs through New Haven all the way up to Springfield, Mass.
Okay.
And then CSX now has a big yard up there. But the little short lines, especially the one that ran behind my school, University of Hartford.
Like CSOR?
It's not CSOR. CNZ, Central New England. Or okay. New England Central.
Oh,
or
no. New England Central. I know them. Yeah. Sure.
No, I think it's Central New England. I can forget. It's a tiny little short line that runs basically from Hartford to Bloomfield.
Oh, okay.
Which is all of maybe 15 miles.
Yeah. Now, do they exist now, or is this will this be like a period sort of a thing?
No, they're still running to this day. And in fact, the biggest customer is a Home Depot supply house.
Okay.
Full circle now.
So are they getting like, you know, center beams and stuff like that?
Yep. They're getting center beams, flats. Every now and then an oddball a freight car, like a steel coil, but for the most part, or a gun for some steel or metals. But for the most part, it's center beams and flats.
Sure.
But the other big industry here in Hartford is trash.
Huh.
And that's kind of fascinating because with trash, it's literally all you have to do is throw a shack up, put a track to it, and bam, it's an industry.
So you must have laid in a supply of those Atlas MSW containers, I'll bet.
Just a little.
Are you the one that bought all of mine that I had on the white elephant table there?
Maybe.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me. They were a little too modern for me.
Wow.
That was back when I was buying everything and I was thinking mm-hmm. I was a 90s modeler.
Right, right. So I decided to focus on actually building my own little short line railroad.
And okay, so this is a proto freelance.
Exactly. It's become a proto freelance design where I'm actually taking elements of different short lines that I've enjoyed. So going back to Phillipsburg for a second, up along the Della River on the New Jersey side, there's actually an old Pennsylvania railroad branch called the Belle Dell.
I've heard of Delaware. It. Yeah. Yeah.
So what's unique about that, or at least what's memorable, is that they've always shoved the train because they don't have passing siding.
Mm-hmm.
So they've always shoved the train from down.
With the caboose?
With the caboose, exactly. So because I wanted to model modern railroad, that gave me the excuse to run a caboose in the modern era.
Yep.
It's a shoving platform.
Yep.
But then again, the industries are heavily influenced by the Connecticut industries. So trash being one, the Home Depot supply is another one, but also in Hartford, we also have a frozen food logistics plant.
Okay.
So now that's given me the excuse to run,
French fries.
Basically, yeah. The old Cryotrans 72 foot box cars, reefer cars.
That's really interesting. So you're going to want, I would think, some decent radius curves because you'll be having some long flat cars, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And what are you thinking for power?
Little switchers, SW15s and MP15s, because there's something unique and just some I'll say it. They're cute.
No, switchers are cool. I have way too many. I just like end cab switchers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's something about them, just seeing them kind of bobbling along the line, pulling actually a whole cut of cars. And that was actually influenced by out in Bethlehem, the PBNE, Philadelphia, Bethlehem, and New England.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's all they have was SW1500s, MP15s, even SW1200s, I think.
Yeah, like the Union Railroad or any of these other steel.
Right.
Yes.
Exactly. Yeah, there's something awesome about seeing them pull a cut of double stack to interchange with Norfolk Southern. So I'm like, okay, I got to have that.
I remember when I was a teenager on my bike down in New Bedford Yard watching a Penn Central SW1500 trying to haul a cut of cars out of New Bedford Yard. And there was a pretty good grade leaving that yard because it had to go up and over Route 18.
Oh, wow.
So mm-hmm. That had to be a 2% grade, but it was, usually when New Haven and Penn Central were doing sort of, road trains out of there, they had a bunch of units.
Right.
So the sole switcher trying to get this cut of cars. And this thing was in run 8 and smoking like an Alco. And I still remember it. It was really impressive. And he made it. Not very fast.
Yeah. So that's the beauty of what with the decoders we have nowadays is you can simulate all of that.
Oh yeah, that's a full throttle feature, and we're going to talk about that in a sec. But before I forget to ask, will your short line have an interchange with a real railroad?
Yes. Yes. So my staging originally started off as just a plain old staging.
Yep.
But then it kind of evolved. Well, if in the background I can tuck in a quote unquote class one main line, and they can interchange at the staging yard.
It's almost like another industry, basically.
Pretty much, exactly. So the staging yard is now going to be Hartford.
Okay.
Because Hartford actually still supports a pretty big yard for the Connecticut Southern CSOR.
So will that be your interchange point?
That would be my interchange point, right. But the way it's constructed, it's so nondescript because it's not really exactly Hartford. It's loosely based on Hartford.
Sure.
I can replace whatever class one power it is. So if I want to backdate it, I could easily throw Conrail power on it, and it's now interchanging with Conrail.
Okay.
Or if I want to fast forward to today, throw the Providence and Worcester that's painted in the Genesee, Wyoming colors, and now it's interchanging with PNW or CSOR.
Well, you can afford to do that, I think, in part because you don't need a ton of power, do you?
No, I don't. Maybe
four or five engines.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, and also too, the
see, that wouldn't work for a locomotive addict like me. I need some way to justify my 109 and counting engines.
Oh, trust me, I have plenty of Conrail six axle power. And every single time Atlas or Athern or even Scale Trains announces something, I'm like, crap.
You know, it's funny. I was just, one of the things that I'm because I've completed the Taylor Yard area, and I'm going to be modeling the Kaiser Industrial Park on the other side of it. There's a big plastics manufacturer there. And I've always wanted a consignee on the layout that can take plastics covered hoppers, right? Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And I always thought that I had a ton of these things. So I went before the show tonight, I was actually going through all the A-line boxes, and I found six. And that doesn't seem like a ton to me.
No,
and half of them are brass.
Oh,
so,
wow.
So I'm thinking, where are all the the plastics covered hoppers that I thought I owned? And I thought maybe they're unbuilt and in boxes. And I went up mm-hmm. to my upstairs sort of train pantry here, and was looking through all of the shelving, and it's not one. And I just sighed, and I thought, all of these cars that I don't need, where are the cars that I need? You know what I mean? So mm-hmm. I'm thinking that I have to carve out some time this winter to sort of rationalize the fleet a little bit and just get, because it's ridiculous. Where are you going to store all this stuff
right,
if you're
exactly.
not going to use it, right? So I'm going to have to sort of beat the bushes for some of these plastics covered mm-hmm. hoppers. I could use another six at least. I see a trip to AA Hobbies.
I was just about to suggest that.
I don't think any of this stuff is in the pipeline at this point.
Oh, for overgrowing scope.
Exactly.
Ever-changing scope.
Well, yeah. And Chris Butts came down and visited a couple of weeks ago, and we had the inevitable, okay, Chris, what doesn't belong here? You know, because he just knows everything from an era standpoint in
right.
particular,
mm-hmm.
you know. So he identified, a good six or eight freight cars that were on the layout that either needed their scheme changed or just plain, would be better off just getting rid of. So mm-hmm. I probably need to kind of go through the A-line boxes with Chris, or even worse, the storage shelving, if I really want to feel depressed about it. But if you clean house on a bunch of other stuff, it also gives you an opportunity to maybe acquire some things that you like better and mm-hmm. are more appropriate. And I'm kind of looking forward to doing that.
Right. I've been such a
layout building mode for, I don't know, it's got to be three or more years here, maybe four.
I was going to say probably closer to four.
Yeah. You probably know better than me. It's all just a blur, but you do come to my clinic, so you'd have a pretty good idea of that. I don't want to be that one-dimensional, but mm-hmm. I'm sort of keenly aware that everything that I've done in the past couple of years was not going to be easier as I got older. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. So right.
I think I have the lion's share now of the heavy lifting pretty much done. You know, there was a point about, I don't know, maybe under a month ago, where I looked at the window of time I had before the next op session, and before Thanksgiving, because I've got family coming up and all of that, so mm-hmm. I didn't want to be in chaos for that.
Right.
And
then with after Thanksgiving, the Christmas holidays is right upon us.
Well, right. So I've got another test op session scheduled for I think it's the 7th of December, because I figured, well, it's after Thanksgiving. and it's before the rest of the craziness in December. So I looked at that and I said, you know, I've got about 2 weeks and a couple of days of a work window here of making a mess. And I said, I'd like to get the partitions up and I'd like to get Taylor Yard in.
Mm-hmm.
And so Taylor Yard was maybe, I don't know, 4 work days, let's say. And the partitions were maybe 3 if you're counting painting and stuff like that.
Okay,
so,
yep.
I was thinking, boy, what else can I do? And then my back went out.
Oh, no.
You know, it happens like every 6 or 7 years, you know, like locusts, I guess. And you've got to listen to your body, right?
Yep.
So this week, I just haven't worked on the layout all week, and it feels really strange, but kind of good. And I was able to knock off a whole bunch of installs. And, you know, my installs tend to get done in, well, I think everything I do tends to get done in these sort of slobbering spurts of activity of a particular kind, you know, whether it's making trees or cleaning up the install, you know, backlog,
right. Mm-hmm.
And you've done a lot of DCC installs, right?
Yep.
If you had to guess, do you have a number?
Probably
ballpark.
At least 50 a year.
For over how many years?
I've been doing this for about 3 years now.
Okay, so you're, you know, above 150 probably.
Probably, yeah.
And I did some numbers myself because I've been, you know, because I'm counting my pre-sound installs because I was doing them then too, right? I was putting
yep.
in
mm-hmm.
NCDASRs. I probably put in 100 of those things, you know. And I added it up, and I'm north of 500. I'm probably close to 600, believe it
or not. Wow.
Which is an absurd number, but that's, you know, admittedly part of that is when you do your own fleet 3 times, right?
So right.
Mm-hmm. I put regular DCC decoders in 100 engines and then yank those out and put tsunamis and then yank those out and put loc sounds. And that's when I said, we're not doing that again.
Until the next best thing comes along.
Well, I just can't see it. It would have to be so unimaginably spectacular to make it worth me doing that again that I just don't see it happening. I think I'm going to run out mm-hmm. of life before I decide that's a good idea. But I you've done enough of them that I don't know, maybe I've run into more weirdness than you have. I think you'd understand that some installs are easier than others.
Oh, for sure. For sure.
And some of them are, you know, I've done some brass engines that were piece of cake and some that were absolute nightmares.
Mm-hmm.
I've done, I think, 3 brass steam engines before it dawned on me that this just isn't a good thing to do.
Well, HO scale brass is not too bad. When you start doing N scale brass,
you've done Oof. N-scale brass?
I've done N-scale brass.
Yeah.
And
see, that's young eyes talking.
Or glutton for punishment, or full hardiness, or yeah.
Or really good optimizers. I think I did 1 N-scale loco once and thought, again, here's something we won't be doing.
Yeah, so actually for me, N-scale isn't too bad. It's once you kind of understand the principles, it's and understand the fundamentals, I think you kind of find shortcuts.
Well, every N-scale engine I looked at is just a solid block of metal. Do you have a milling machine?
I've actually, for the N-scales, I try to use as much drop-ins as possible.
Okay. So in other words, if it's a modern N scale DCC ready kind of locomotive,
yep,
mm-hmm. that's one thing. But
right.
I would imagine that you've at least been asked to do some of the more traditional, you know, like a Kato HONW2, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They're basically built like that,
solid.
Except small.
Exactly. Yeah, and in those instances, I do have to find, I do have to have Lou help me mill the, our buddy Lou Papineau, mill out a pocket for me to drop the decoder in.
Yeah, he's got a milling machine.
Yeah, he's got the milling machine, so.
My milling machine is one of my single most useful things I ever bought. It's, I don't know how I ever claim to do installs without that, because I tend to work on a lot of legacy power. Mm-hmm. My typical customer is, okay, they bought some modern engines that have Loc sounds in them, and now they want the rest of their fleet to be like that.
Right, exactly.
So I've been milling out a lot of locomotives for both myself and customers, basically, you know, because when you come right down to it, if it's a modern drop-in kind of situation, locomotive-wise, I'm not adding a whole lot of value to that, really.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It's the ones where people don't want to do it themselves that make it worth you actually getting involved with it, if that makes sense.
Right. You're more entrenched into the project.
Exactly. Exactly. And I mean, you know, it doesn't – I mean, think of how many – installs you've done that at drop-ins that you're still adding value because you're picking the right speaker, you've got all the tricks to put it in place. I'm just wondering what you use for N-scale speakers.
Well, thankfully none of the N-scale stuff has been sound, but the one or two that I've done for sound, I've just pretty much used the sugar cubes, the one that TCS makes. I forget the part number, but it's a sugar cube, but it's like two-thirds of the size of a standard sugar cube.
How does it sound?
It's not too bad. I mean, it's still hard to compare when you're going up against the iPhone, but it does a fair job, and especially in N-scale. I know one of the things I'm kind of known for is my speaker clinic, and I've mentioned one of the things, new technology I'm kind of looking into is wearables, like your smartwatches and whatnot.
Oh, interesting.
A lot of them do have speaker capability because you're either listening to music with it or it's reading out a text message back to you or that type of thing.
Have you actually fooled around with any of those speakers?
I've tried, and surprisingly, those speakers are way harder to find than the cell phone speakers.
They're too new,
but I also think that the way wearables are designed, they're really designed to be disposable.
Oh, I see.
So when it goes bunk, you just go out and buy a new one.
That's one expensive disposable, but I guess it's like microsurgery, right? So mm-hmm. How would you, yeah.
Yeah. So so I have gotten a hand on one of them, but it the output of it was disappointing. It ended up being very soft and very low volume. So I'm starting to doubt if it even was a speakerphone for a smartwatch rather than just the earpiece of the earpiece speaker from a phone.
Right. Well,
but if we can break that barrier, I think that opens up a whole new area for N-scale sound.
You know, it's funny because I was just talking with our buddy Mike Confalone this week, and one of the conversations we were having was, you know, I mean, he's the kind of guy that he wakes up in the morning or can't get to sleep at night with some new idea and can't wait to call me in the morning and have me tell him what's wrong with the idea. But he is very interested in incorporating somehow some underlayout sound to sort of enhance the rail fanning experience on a model railroad. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's something we've talked about for years. And, you know, the pros I think are obvious. And so my job was to sort of bring up a lot of the potential cons. And we basically decided that we needed to sort of do a test case and just see how it hits us.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
Stay tuned for updates on that down the road, because we'll probably be doing that this winter. And it could be as simple as another decoder talking to a pair of powered speakers that you consist in with your yard switcher, for example.
Mm-hmm.
for a road train, much more difficult to, I think, do that properly. But, you know, I'm not going to rule it out. I think, you know, we might surprise ourselves as we get into the problem-solving aspect of this, which is always something I enjoy.
For sure. I know, there's a thought maybe you could think about trying. I know some Digitrax decoders have that transponding feature. I wonder if you could set up a LocalNet bus and then use that decoder to trigger another recording. Or actually, you know what? Maybe this might be actually a good project for like an Arduino.
Well, but then how are you, you know, obviously it's got to be low sound compatible, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you have the recording that you want and you have a decoder that can take that recording, are you talking about multiple decoders basically?
Possibly, kind of like almost daisy chaining it.
Yeah.
And
that way you wouldn't be, but in other words, how would you do the forwarding? Because that's sort of the whole trick here, isn't it?
Right. Well, that's the thing, is that you could probably have an Arduino that's triggered by a event. I'd have to think about it a little more, but I wonder if you could set up a network of Arduinos.
Now, wait a minute. Now, I thought an Arduino was like a little servo motor. Am I thinking about this wrong?
An Arduino is actually a microprocessor, a miniature computer.
Oh, okay.
That can control a servo.
Okay, maybe that's why I associated them. But how would it interact in this case?
I have to think about it a little more. But basically, if you have an event that, say, you start at module one, right?
Right, right.
The way you hook up the Arduinos, you can hook them up in series, almost in daisy chains. So
okay.
You use the pin to forward, okay, I've activated, okay, next one, next Arduino module two. You trigger in
so you could
seconds.
Turn decoders on and off, basically.
Exactly. Use it like a little flagman.
This sounds like real trouble.
The things you can think.
And I suppose you could program it to also turn the previous one off.
Right, exactly.
Like toggle from one to the next.
Mm-hmm. Right. So you build in essence.
Sounds like something we need to talk further about once we get into this, because to me that was the obstacle, right?
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever been to Mike's house?
I have not had the opportunity. I would love to.
His layout is, I think, similar in size to mine. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of the things that I've done were heavily influenced by learning to run at his place. You know, because mm-hmm. he was ahead of me, and it's a very well-designed layout in that it is designed so you follow your train. It's designed so that you feel like you're going somewhere. All familiar things that we've just talked about, right? You focus on individual scenes, some of them larger than others, some of them really large. But in all cases, he's done a good job of controlling your eye. In other mm-hmm. words, you're looking at what he wants you to look at just automatically.
Right.
So the trick with the sound will be to make sure that it doesn't destroy or interfere with that in any way, you know?
Right. And the trick is, I think it's doable,
particularly with the techniques you're talking about here, but you need that kind of control.
Right, exactly. But then also too, the where you place your speakers actually make a huge impact too.
Well, what we're trying to sort of make up for, which everybody's complaint, is the lack of low end, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the pro and the con is that low end is basically non-directional.
Right.
So the good part of that is, you know, as you go from one side of your scene to the next, you're not going to notice that the low end isn't sort of traveling with the engine until you get mm-hmm. out of that scene. But I wonder, my concern was without the ability to switch, you know, it's going to bleed.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And interfere with other activities. You know what I mean? So mm-hmm. I think the ability to sort of have it follow your train might be critical. So how do you program these things? Do you need Craig Biesgeier to do it, or can a mere mortal do it?
Probably, because it is going to be a little more customized software rather than using off-the-shelf components.
I mean, what do you program them in or with?
Arduinos are programmed. I believe C++ is the language.
Oh, okay. So anybody who can do that can do what they need to with this.
Pretty much. Yeah, exactly.
And do you just write to NVRAM or something? Like how does it work?
Yeah. So built into the Arduino itself is basically a RAM. Actually, it's an EEPROM. It's an EEPROM memory.
Okay.
So you basically write your code up on a standard computer. Then you plug it in via USB and then compile it and then force it down into the Arduino. And then once you power it up, it automatically executes. And it just runs through the lines just like a regular computer would.
What would actuate the, would you need some kind of detection to basically trigger it?
Yeah, some sort of detection where it could be either current, it could be current, optical, and there's another form of detection.
Infrared? Would that also be optical?
That would be optical. Read switches. That's what I was thinking.
How would that work?
Like
pressure?
Not pressures, magnets.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you can easily put little reed switches, which nowadays they're tiny, tiny, tiny. They're basically a little glass vial.
Or a magnet in the caboose?
A magnet in the caboose or even under the front truck of the locomotive.
Wow.
So as the magnet passes over, it makes a contact. And when the Arduino senses a drop or a spike in current due to the magnet closing the switch, you can trigger it.
Sounds doable, and it sounds a little complicated.
Yeah, that's the beauty about thinking about all of these technology is that it's endless with what you can do. If you can dream it, someone out there can build it.
Well, it's kind of groundbreaking in a way because devil's in the details, but if you come up with a way to do this, I would think any serious model railroader would be interested in it.
Mm.
Hmm. All right. We'll have to take that as an offline discussion then.
Absolutely.
Hmm. So how long do you think it'll be before you're done scraping your popcorn?
Actually, my goal is to have an operating layout, maybe not scenic, but fully functional, but in 2 years' time. The reason being is in 2021, we being the Nutmeg Division of the NMRA, is hosting the regional convention that year.
So you'd like to be open for business?
I would like to be open for business, yes.
You know what? You have to have a goal.
Absolutely.
Because if you don't have a goal, you won't hit it.
Exactly.
I mean,
easy to say, okay, because I'll just do it tomorrow.
I mean, you probably have a little bit of project manager chops in you, so you get that. But it's funny how if you just never make a plan, you just sort of muddle along and nothing really happens.
Yep.
By the same token, I would never want to make it. I often tell people that there are two kinds of people who come over and visit the layout and see it for the first time. Only two. They can be put in these two categories. One category of person is just fascinated and they look at it and they start asking questions, and the next thing you know, it's an hour later. And you know, they, even though they may not be into trains, they just, mm-hmm. they just see, wow, it's cool. And then the other kind of person says, wow, when's it going to be done? And you just look at them and you think, like, you're not a process
really?
Person, are you? For me, the goal is to enjoy the process, mm-hmm. and to acknowledge that the process really doesn't have to end. You know,
right. Mm-hmm.
A lot of people have said to me, what are you going to do when it's done? And I try to explain patiently that I don't really see the hobby in the fact that you're building a layout, which is a giant system, right? There's
right.
all these aspects of it. I just can't even conceive of it being quote unquote done.
Done, right.
I'll be happy to see it all presentable, basically, you know, and
right.
then I can get a chance to sort of revisit so many different areas and improve them to what my vision is, and at the same time work on freight cars and work mm-hmm. on locomotives, and you know what I mean, there's this like endless amounts of things to do. You know
yes.
what'll be done someday? Carpentry.
Yep.
Now fortunately I enjoy carpentry, and I've really enjoyed building out the Lehigh bench work in the new section, and mm-hmm. and you know, and doing it right and having a workshop that I can do it right in. It took great pleasure in doing that. But when I'm done with it, I'm not going to be sitting around thinking, gee, no more bench work to build. You know, I mean, I'll be content that it's all up and busying myself with other aspects, you know what
right,
I mean?
Right, exactly. There's plenty of things to do, and layout's never truly done. And usually it's almost in some ways like everything becomes a nail.
That's right.
You find, oh wait, that could be done better. Let me do this, and then next thing you know, boom, there's another project when it was already completed.
Now, just to bring up Confalone again real quick, he built his entire layout with a chop saw.
That's impressive.
Well, whenever I go up there to do anything on his layout, I always kid him and I say, this is a mission to Mars. If I don't bring it, it's not going to be here. I remember one day I said, I need a file. And he looked at me and says, I don't have a file. And I just kind of tilted my head and said, who doesn't have a file? I mean, it was just incredible to me. I made him go to the hardware store and buy a freaking file because, you know, I think I gave him a VOM because, uh-huh. you know, I need a debug tool when I go up there. It's incredible to me that he built a solid, perfectly
wow.
running layout uh-huh. with a chop saw.
With just the chop saw.
I use my entire workshop all the time. I'd be mm-hmm. lost without my band saw. And, you know, I use my radial saw to cut long lengths, and I use my table saw to rip things. And it's like, how do you build an entire giant layout with a chop saw? But I wanted to ask you, how are you planning to do the bench work and things like that? Will the bench work be just basically straightforward 1x4s and, you know, yeah. a chop mm-hmm. saw and a good screw gun is all you need?
Pretty much, yeah. I was actually lucky in the fact that in my last job, they had 2x8s of pink insulation foam that
okay.
they were just getting rid of. I'm like, mine.
Yeah.
So
and that's not cheap.
No, it wasn't. I think they had like half a dozen or so sheets that they were just getting ready to junk. I was like, you can throw it in my car. I'll throw it out for you.
Sounds like a good head start. Now, are you thinking of using it as the substrate on top of the benchwork?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. And I know some people say that it's going to be noisy and whatnot, but the test pieces I've laid out, it didn't seem too bad, and I'm not going at high speeds.
It's kind of counterintuitive to think that foam would be noisy, isn't it?
Right, exactly.
But, you know, as you might recall, I used 1.5 foam on top of my swing gate.
Mm-hmm.
And the first time that I ran a train across it, when the train went from benchwork onto the gate, I sort of jumped out of my skin because I thought the train had derailed. It was just a completely different sound and much louder.
Uh-huh.
And I wasn't expecting that because I haven't really used foam before as
right.
the substrate. So I think it's probably going to, are you going to use cork glued to it? Because that'll help a lot.
Yeah. The cork, I'm playing around with Rapido has their foam.
Oh, I bought some of that.
Oh,
that
really?
That might even be better, actually.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm thinking, too. And what I love about it is that they actually have the branch line profile.
Well, that's what I bought, you know. So I'm using it in areas where I want to get a differential between mean and siding. Siding, whatever,
right.
You know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's actually been pretty good. I just put it down with DAP and put the track on it with DAP. And that's something that has been new to me, is gluing the track down. I highly recommend it.
Okay.
It is. It makes a big, big difference in terms of the speed of how you do it.
Uh-huh.
I think you get good at determining the right thickness very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And the good part is the track just stays put. But if you change your mind, you can get it up without much of a problem.
Of a problem, right?
And if I had to spike down everything that I laid out there track wise, I would have bogged down. I mean, I went through.
Well, I was going to say you would have 25. Had monster grip.
Oh my gosh! It, you know, I went through probably 6 boxes of 25 a box track.
Wow!
You know, because the staging yards just eat track.
Oh yeah, yards.
And I have 3 staging yards.
Mm-hmm.
And then of course I had to do Taylor Yard, and I've got, you know, miles of main line and all of that. So there's no question that. I don't know where I saw it or who recommended it to me, but I did some test things and when I was doing some rebuilds in the old section of the layout, and old school and a lot of things, but there's no question that adopting some newer techniques have really saved me a ton of time. You know, like using foam instead of the old plaster cloth that I used to back in the day. You know, I don't have 1 square inch of that anymore on the layout, but I can't tell you how much of that stuff that I put down back in the day, you know. Techniques I don't miss, you know, screen wire.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yikes.
Yeah. No, and that's the thing, is that your layout serves actually as a huge inspiration for me too, especially when it comes once I get closer to that scenery stage, how fast you're able to kind of get in hillsides and how well you're able to cover it in such a short depth, in a very shallow depth.
I credit Confalon with that because, in many ways, he's more impatient to get something done. Mm-hmm. And I think that he also works in furious spurts with long breaks in between, and he never would have done like a hard shell kind of mm-hmm. thing there, you know. And mm-hmm. and in fact, he got me using the green florist foam,
really,
and then switched over to just regular closed cell foam like your pink and green stuff.
Okay.
Because of just, you know, expense.
Right.
I buy it at 60% off at EC Moore. So I'm just back and forth there. Whenever they have a sale, I'm on their mailing list. I just go down there, and sometimes with a buddy, and buy some foam, you know.
Right. Just load up.
And I've bought at this point hundreds of, you know, 1x3 hunks of this green stuff. But it changed everything for me, because when you plant, you know, I'm up to close to 3,500 trees at this point.
Only 3,500?
Yeah, I've got probably another couple thousand to go, believe it or not. But I know that seems like a ridiculous number.
Welcome to the Northeast.
Exactly. You can't model Pennsylvania without having a couple of trees, right?
Oh, yes.
So especially the summer time.
Exactly.
You know, that I'm modeling. So for me, the ability to easily and effortlessly plant trees and move them, you know, because Mike was saying, you know, I just make a hole with a scratch awl and stick the tree in. And I said, okay, try that 3,000 times. Now you're doing 6,000 things, right? And when you start thinking about it in those kinds of numbers, you know, it makes a big difference, you know.
Right, exactly.
I just find that the open cell green florist foam is easy to work with. You can plant things in it well, carves very easily.
Mm-hmm.
And because I'm doing tree canopy most of the time, I don't have to be that fussy with the shape of it, you know.
Right, exactly.
When I first started doing it, I was like blending it with sculpt the mold and stuff. Can't see any of that once you get trees on it, you know.
Uh-huh.
So I busied myself with just making sure that I had the tree thing down.
Right.
In fact, I had a panicked moment not too long ago where I saw the weather closing in. I said, I gotta have some trees for the winter. So I spent like a week just picking super tree armatures and going out in the yard and spraying them. And I've got a, you know, big boxes now of painted armatures. Not nearly enough, But sometimes you're working on an area where you need to work from back to front. Mm-hmm. If you didn't have some trees to put back there, it would prevent you really from doing what you really want to do. And I didn't want to be in that circumstance.
Kind of box yourself into a corner in that case.
Yeah, exactly. And if we get any mild weather between now and when the winter really clamps down on us here in the Northeast, I'll try to do at least one or two more rounds of it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
No guarantees, but at least whatever I did is better than nothing. I think I picked about a whole super tree, you know, the giant super value case. I did about one of those, and I've got three more of those to pick. So. I'll scrape your popcorn if you want to pick some super trees.
Deal.
Yeah. Well, Kaylee, I really enjoyed your being on. Now, this is not the only podcast that you're on, of course, right? You're on at least one other, or is it several?
Couple. So I'm pretty much regular on Lionel Strang's podcast, A Modeler's Life.
Sure. Is that a weekly thing?
Yeah, he actually puts out two episodes a week.
Boy, are you on both?
No. The way he does it works is kind of whenever, whoever. So he actually has a structure where twice a month or every other week is basically what he calls an episode, which is a formal interview.
Okay.
And then the other weeks where it's just filled in with just basically kind of
a gang.
Right. A gang, loose antics. Sometimes we go over, we do what's called a viewer posts. Basically we go to the Facebook page and just kind of read comments or posts that people have shared on the Facebook page, and that generates an episode or two. We do sometimes viewer mails, people who write in to the podcast, and we read the email, and that generates a couple episodes. And then sometimes too, when we're just shooting the breeze occasionally, someone comes up with an interesting topic, he literally just hits the record button and then we record an episode right then and there.
I gotcha. So are these podcasts something that you need to catch live, or are they available to listen to for anybody that wants to just at any time?
Yep. So actually, if you go to the Modeler's Life page, www.amodelerslife.com, modelers with one L, you can scroll down to a page, I think it's called, it was a button called Libsyn, and that's where he hosts the podcast, and you can catch all the free episodes there. He also does have a Patreon channel to host some additional content. And that is, you do have to pay to get access to that. I think it's like $5 a month. And that will bring you to the Patreon site, which then has another batch of episodes and whatnot you can listen to there as well. The formal episodes are always on the free channel. Some of the antic stuff, the fun stuff, is on the Patreon side. But occasionally they do get posted on the free side as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, storage isn't free, so that actually makes a lot of sense. And what is the other podcast?
Is Tom Barbalay's Model Rail Radio.
Oh, yes. Now, this is going to be very embarrassing for me, but I was on one of these two podcasts at one point many years ago.
Uh-huh.
It might have been Tom's, but it might have been Lionel's, and I just don't remember.
I know, it's such a blur, right?
Well, it shouldn't be, but trust me, it doesn't get easier as you get older. And I've always got a lot of balls in the air, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it seems like in terms of memory stuff, I'm sort of triaging at any given time. That means mm-hmm. a third of the stuff goes right out the window. It's only so much RAM.
Right, exactly. Well, it happens to the best of us.
Well, thanks for coming on, and something tells me we may have to revisit some of these topics at some point in the future, you know?
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
I hope you have a great holiday, and the same to all of my listeners.
Thank you. You too, Mike.
See everybody, I guess, next month.
Adios.